Hi, and welcome to Talking to Charlie. I'm your host, Charlie, and this is my podcast, hoping to extend a hand, if you like, to all those who have been directly or indirectly affected by cancer in their lives, as well as all the other challenges that life can sometimes throw at us. Today, I'm absolutely thrilled that Professor George Follows will be talking to Charlie. George is one of the country's leading haematologists, and fortunately for me, is my oncologist. Today, we're going to be talking about various aspects of cancer, including its prevalence, complexity, and impact, before focusing more specifically on George's specialist field and that of blood cancer, in particular, Hodgkin lymphoma. The advancements in modern medicine, screening and therapeutics, the future of cancer, and how retaining a positive mental attitude can really help influence your treatment and journey. I'm really excited, and I hope you guys are too. So without further ado, let's bring the man in himself. George, hello, and welcome.
Hi, Charlie. Thank you for the invite.
Not at all. So I'm honoured to actually say you are my first and potentially last guest on Talking to Charlie. But I should also point out it is a Saturday because you inherently are a very, very busy man. So your time is valuable.
I am honoured to be here with you, Charlie. So thanks.
Right. And actually in a different guise. So for those who don't already know, George is my oncologist. Going back, I think it was 15 years now. Was instrumental in changing my life for the better. But on this occasion, this is very much an informal conversation. I'm not going to get an invoice from you. I hope not, certainly after the show.
I'll let you off, Charlie. I'll let you off.
Just on this occasion, yes, cancer comes in all sort of shapes and sizes, but obviously your sort of your prowess, if you like, is very much in the blood cancer field. So, you know, yeah. But, you know, we can try and touch on a few sort of generic things typically in sort of the broader landscape of cancer, but obviously knowing full well that, you know, thank God, for my purposes anyway, rather selfishly, you know, blood cancer was or is your specialist subject. So just sort of diving straight in, George, if you wouldn't mind, there was a stat going back 15 years. I think it was 1 in 3 people are likely to be affected by cancer in their lives. Fast forward 15 years, and that is now 1 in 2, which quite frankly, from the outside looking in, is pretty terrifying by all accounts. But at the same point, and you know better than I would, you know, we'd like to think that there is obviously advance or progress being made in all things treatment and medicine and otherwise. But, you know, from those stats alone, is that encouraging? Probably not. Or is it just something that is sort of testament that, you know, cancer sort of continues to win, if you like?
Well, no, come on, Charlie. Let's not go for something so depressing as cancer.
Yes, right, okay, fair. Good man. Wind it back.
Wind it back. So you say some kind words in the introduction, Charlie. So for your listeners, to remind them, I am a blood cancer specialist. I'm one of the consultants in Cambridge. Of course, we do overlap and interact a lot with solid organ oncology. So we get a lot of general experience in cancer medicine in the work we do, but I'm not a specialist in other cancers. So my opinions are naturally over-influenced, I suspect, by my work in the blood cancer field. But yeah, so you started off by raising that interesting statistic about how many human beings are going to get cancer across their lifespan. So Charlie, I think there are some things to reflect on there. Number one, many, many cancers are diseases of older people. Now, you were a bit unlucky, of course. You got one of the young person cancers, but they're still relatively uncommon in younger people. There are some unlucky folk, there are unlucky families, et cetera, but generally, a marker of a population that is living longer, and that means they're not dying from earlier cardiovascular deaths and other things that are infectious deaths that we used to die from as a population a lot younger. So a marker is that more people get cancer. Now, of course, there are the headline terrible cancers. You can't walk away from, you know, pancreatic cancer. You can list things which are still very challenging where we've made few breakthroughs. But there are many other types of cancers that actually present in some ways a bit like a long-standing condition that people have. And again, drawing on my own field with the blood cancers, we have quite a few of our disorders that present in more elderly individuals. And you know what? They often don't hugely impact on their life. And I'm saying that very carefully because, of course, you'll have some of your listeners where that simply is not the case. But there is I don't want to say some lightness behind that pretty tough statistic, but I hear what you're saying. The actual numbers in the population that 1 in 2, 1 in 3 of us are going to be directly affected by cancer firsthand. And of course, if you take your relatives and friends, it's inevitable that cancer is going to be knocking on your door.
Yeah, because, you know, the premise of this show is very much as a resource to sort of help those directly or indirectly affected by cancer. And, you know, as we just alluded to, I think it's inevitable, or, you know, that every single individual is going to be affected by cancer at some point in their lives.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah.
So I can't argue against that one.
No, exactly. But basically, in a summary there, it's people are inherently living longer, but the sort of the broader sort of cancer landscape, if you like, has more effect on the sort of elder demographic, if you like, as opposed to the young. As you alluded to, me, you know, Hodgkin's lymphoma, I think inherently it sort of affects those between the age of 20 and 40 that tend to live quite a healthy lifestyle, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, Hodgkin's is a strange quirk. One of the things makes Hodgkin's very interesting is it's got this unusual type of presentation. It actually has what we call a biphasic age distribution, Charlie, to use a technical word.
Do elaborate, because I've completely confused by that already.
Well, it's the commonest cancer in young adults. So if you look at the distribution of ages, so the commonest time to get Hodgkin lymphoma is probably between about 18 and 24. It then sort of drops off. So me, age 55, I'm sort of probably at that bottom end. But then Hodgkin's actually starts to rise again. And Hodgkin lymphoma in more elderly people becomes common again. They've got slightly different biologies behind them and unfortunately different outcomes. And I say that meaning that younger people, we now cure the very clear majority of young people who present with Hodgkin lymphoma. Older folk, it's not always as easy. Biology of the Hodgkin's is a bit different, and they tolerate the more intensive treatments less well. So our chances of getting a cure are not quite as good. But Hodgkin's is a bit odd. And I think it is worth reminding your listeners that many, many cancers, without getting too stuck in molecular biology, are almost like a random degenerative disease of DNA. And I've got to translate that. I'll translate it. So human beings, we are, of course, highly, highly complex organisms, and we are a collection of cells, and the cells themselves are made up because of that amazing complexity of the genomic environment. So our DNA with 4 billion base pairs in each cell, hard to even get to grips with what that means, but those 25,000 genes that are working away, and each cell is making its proteins, doing its signaling, speaking to the next cell. It might be saying, I'm a healthy functioning liver cell, or it might be saying, I'm a bowel cell, or I'm a breast cell, or a brain cell, etc., etc. They're working away, but cells divide, they grow, they die off, but there is random DNA damage that is picked up randomly. Now, you might accelerate your DNA damage by lying in the sun. You might accelerate it by smoking cigarettes. You might
Was that a direct assassination at me?
I will at some point. tell your listeners about Charlie and how much he ignored my strong advice about lying.
I can edit this, you do realise.
You should, Charlie, you should. But the basic principle is life over your 70, 80 years is lots of cellular division, growth, and you just pick up random bits of DNA through life. Now, your environment, and there are all these things we can talk about, your diet, your lifestyle, your immune system, all of these things influence rates of accumulation of damage or whether damaged cells are killed off properly. It's a very complex picture. But the bottom line is you get more cancers as you get older because you've had more time to pick up the damage. And so that's a sort of this broad thing is why cancers generally get more common in older people.
Right. Okay. Because I was going to sort of pay mention to that. You know, blood cancer, as you say, sort of DNA related. But you know, it's if there was anything you could sort of give advice to listeners to say, you know, what can I be doing as a kind of preventative, be that, you know, diet, exercise, avoid sun or everything otherwise. You can only try so hard, but sometimes it's a case of C'est la vie, right?
Well, I think it is really important that your listeners understand that many cancers are totally random and out of the blue. I mean, Hodgkin lymphoma, you pointed out at the beginning, it tends to affect sort of often quite clean living souls that, you know, they've done nothing wrong in their life and it springs out on them. Not everyone. Hodgkin's can associate with things which suppress the immune system. You know, medications doctors give them, HIV, uncontrolled. There are all sorts of things that can associate with Hodgkin's. But most Hodgkin lymphoma patients, it's just come out of the blue. And that's that random shuffle of life. And, you know, without getting too stuck on the biology of that, we've got a bit of a handle on that. A lot of them are driven by the everyday Epstein-Barr virus. You know, glandular fever virus, kissing virus. I'm sure, Charlie, you were never.
It's been a while, mate. but you mentioned that sort of cycle. So 20 to 40 in terms of sort of, I don't know, prime pinpoint, if you like. And then a sort of relapse, not a relapse, but, you know, then sort of come 70, 75. Why might that be?
Yeah, so again, that might the older ones might reflect the gradual failing of the immune system. I mean, I don't want to keep going on about how old age associates with all sorts of body failures.
I don't want to grow old at this rate.
No, I know, Charlie, but it basically does. As we age, our immune system weakens, our surveillance for cancers weakens. Just at the time when, as I just talked about, your cells are aging, you've got more DNA mutations, you're more likely to randomly spin off a malignant cell. And you've got your sleepy immune system that's gradually going to sleep and it doesn't pick them off, doesn't lend them, so they allow them to grow. So more elderly Hodgkin's probably reflects that. The younger people Hodgkin's, a lot of it, as I was touching on there with the glandular fever virus, you know, it can just a slightly abnormal processing of the glandular fever virus in the B cells, that part of the immune system which makes your antibody cells. They get invaded by the Epstein-Barr. We normally clear them, and I must stress to your listeners, 90% of the UK population has had glandular fever, and the tiniest fraction gets Hodgkin lymphoma. So, you know, don't go out panicking. But there probably is the randomness that connects a lot of young people between an Epstein-Barr viral infection and getting Hodgkin lymphoma.
Right, okay. So going back to that 1 in 2, we shouldn't be too disheartened by that because, as you say, it's an aging sort of population, et cetera, and otherwise. So in the positive there, to counteract that, we'd pay mention to the advancements or the progress being made in medicine and treatments and such like. You know, being an expert in your field, are you encouraged by what you see in terms of, you know, be that UK, Europe, whatever, otherwise America, you know, all the sort of those brains in the cancer world coming together? Are you encouraged by what you see in terms of that sort of
progress? It's remarkable, Charlie. So the progress in cancer medicine, of course, it starts with understanding preventative measures. It then moves to screening. It then moves to early intervention and then moves to therapeutics. So actually, the advances happen at every step of the way. And the prevention, I didn't answer your question earlier about, you know, lifestyle, keeping healthy. Every doctor moans and they tell people they shouldn't drink, shouldn't lie in the sun, shouldn't smoke. All the things that we know we basically shouldn't do.
The good things in life.
If you enjoy it, if it's nice, you probably shouldn't do it. There you go. So you shouldn't do all of that. The prevention. Healthy lifestyle choices. I think we have to accept there are significant breakthroughs there. Gosh, my wife was reading something last week in the Time supplement. We've got to eat 30 grams of different types of nuts every day. Remember, I'm not a nutritionist, so don't take one. It's what I read. And so you've got to do all that type of thing. So those count as breakthroughs, I guess we should say, shouldn't we, Charlie? What about the other next step? I said screening tools. Oh, my goodness. The world of screening is going to be changing. So we have screening programs. Of course, we've got breast cancer screening. There's a bit of a debate about PSA as a screening for prostate cancer. So I think, is it over 50 you get offered a PSA test? You've then got the bowel cancer screening, which is detecting blood in the stool. And I should have done a bit of reading to remind myself. I think that's after 60, but I'm sorry if I got that wrong. So screening, But the amazing advances coming away with screening are going to be molecular biology tools. So you may, or your listeners may have heard of this term, next generation sequencing, which is a remarkable breakthrough that was coming around when I was a postdoc here in Cambridge. So 15, 18 years ago, is how you can sequence vast amounts of DNA in a relatively quick time. And it's allowed us to do the whole genome sequencing of humans, for instance. Wind forward to why that matters for cancer screening. Well, cancers secrete tiny bits of DNA into the blood. So somebody with breast cancer or pancreas or kidney or bowel, etc., they're secreting small little bits that circulate around in the blood. And because each cancer tends to have clusters of mutations in the DNA, a bit like a fingerprint. So this one might be saying, this little cluster is a bit typical of a bowel cancer. This little cluster, a bit typical of a lymphoma or lymphoid. And there's increasing data that supports the validity of these tests, that if you take a healthy donor, take their blood, do a whole generation, next generation sequencing, so we are talking billions of data points, but feeds through the computer, powerful algorithms interrogate it, and it might spit out, you know what, pancreas signal. Or might spit out lymphoid signal. And so you can see that although this is still a little experimental, but I suspect this is going to go mainstream, that this type of thing will roll out and then people may say, you know what, whether or not this is nationally commissioned, it might become commercially available, et cetera, et cetera. But you can see how cancer screening can move to a whole different level of using molecular biology to hunt for early cancers.
Right, yeah, because I was going to pay mention, you know, in terms of symptoms or early signs, I know sort of me personally, it wasn't until my lymph nodes above my collarbone had started swelling and I sort of had a motley collection of all sort of shapes and sizes, except and otherwise, as well as sweating and sort of on the relap point of view, I'd lie in bed and I would almost find myself weaning because I think from the pressure in my chest. But you know, if something is migrating in the chest, therefore not showing any sort of particular immediate symptoms, going back to your point, the whole sort of screening process or even just a regular blood test of some description would be very much advised just for those that are trying to sort of, you know, just keep a healthy body, healthy mind, or just at least sort of understand what might be going on in one's body, particularly from a cancer.
So, Charlie, because you, of course, are talking there about a symptomatic presentation of lymphoma. Right. And to recap, Hodgkin lymphoma most typically presents in young people with a lump lower down in the neck, perhaps, and in the mediastinum, what we call the middle bit of the chest. So those are the commonest places. And young people with a mediastinal Hodgkin's can sometimes have a persisting cough, have some tightness, feel their breathing isn't right, et cetera, et cetera. And it's one of the reasons why we encourage people to get a chest x-ray if they've got persisting symptoms around the chest, looking for something. But that isn't necessarily screening. That's trying to diagnose somebody who's coming with a symptom and going to their doc saying, you know what, doc, I'm just not well. 6 months ago, I was running around playing football and now I got this sort of tightness in my breathing and I got a lump at the bottom of my neck. Yeah. So that's quite different from screening. But I think the whole thing, the premise being what are our advances in cancer medicine? I think it's screening the asymptomatic patient, getting things early, because a lot of cancers, we must remember, still are treated with surgical approaches. You know, the lumpectomy, the mastectomy, the resecting of bowel cancer. This type of thing is still of fundamental importance to a lot of solid organ cancers. Now, with the blood cancers, it's a bit different. We tend to, as you know, use chemotherapy and radiotherapy.
Yeah. Wow, fascinating. Okay, I'm not sure where to go from here. Well, I'm sort of bamboozled by this sort of information overload.
Well, I mean, I'm going to help you a bit, Charlie, because you did ask me to talk about the advances in cancer, and I sort of cut you off by sort of doing it's almost like an essay plan. I said, well, let's not jump straight to therapeutics. Let's talk about lifestyle and prevention. But in terms of therapeutics, you said, am I encouraged by what I see? And we have gone through, are going through, and will continue to go through a complete revolution in cancer therapeutics. And in my world, in chronic leukemia. I was giving a talk to our national patient group earlier in the year, and it was quite actually earlier in the year. It was in March last year, but because of the pandemic had got in the way, et cetera, et cetera. So a few years had passed since I'd done my last talk. And this is no exaggeration. The talk from the last time I presented to the national group, I could keep all of the introduction slides about the disease and the lifestyle and the welfare and how it presents. But every single slide talking about the treatment, I replaced. I got rid of all my old chemotherapy and what you do here, because that is a great example of how we've got these amazing new targeted therapies. We have targeted antibodies. We have targeted small molecule inhibitors. We've now got targeted immune modulators that help bring our own immune systems to attack the cancer. It is quite remarkable what is happening. And when we go to the conferences and we debate with colleagues and we talk with biotech and we talk with pharma, there are even more exciting things coming. So you've been blown away by last year's stuff. And then you start talking to some clever guys who are running some cutting edge biotech. And oh my goodness, I had no idea that might be a target. And it is amazing. It's very uplifting.
This is awesome. Really encouraging by all accounts, right? This is sort of intel from the inside. And, you know, just as you say, for people listening, recently diagnosed or otherwise, you know, this is a massive takeaway in terms of sort of the positivity around, as you say, the advancements being made. So. Happy days. I'd almost do a little round of applause for that one.
Well, don't applaud me. That's
probably why you're avoiding these presentations, right? Because you know you've got to keep changing those slides inherently because everything keeps changing and updating. Right. So, well, that's really encouraging. So that's fantastic news. Just going more on a personal level, because, you know, every time I see you, you know, we don't have regular checkups now, but you have a wry smile. You have this sort of amazing energy and warmth about you want to come into your consultation room. But, you know, outside of the treatment, most people are there, or people are there generally because there is a diagnosis or there is concern. And, you know, you have to ultimately relay the news to your patient. And I can't even imagine how you even start that process, you know, in terms of informing a patient. Yeah, unfortunately, mate, you know, it is what it is. You have cancer. But,
well, yeah, I mean, Charlie, it is, of course, a fundamental part of working in my specialty. So you have to.
Do you need training for it? I mean, I wouldn't even know. Like,
yeah, oh, no.
You as a great personality, or
there are many, many courses you can go on, all sorts of different communication skills courses, Charlie. But I mean, there are things you've got to remember. You've got to remember fundamental things that the poor person in front of you, they are terrified. Of course they're terrified. You've got to realize that they are going to have their own set of emotional responses. Some people cry, some people are lost, some people clearly just cannot take in the information you're giving them. And I think, I mean, I've been doing this job in Cambridge for 20 years now. I've run our lymphoma program for, a long time, 15, 16 years. And so, of course, you see all types. And there is not a good way or a bad way to receive bad news. Each individual is very different. But, of course, there are strategies that are more effective. I mean, it has to be face-to-face. You have to have time. And you've got to also keep things really straightforward in that first meeting. Because even when I've got one of my university academics who, as you know, Cambridge is full of super bright, engaged people who within a month...
I wouldn't know, I never went. But yes, I heard on the grapevine.
Yeah, no, Charlie, I'm going to put you in that category. Yeah, within a month, they've done loads of research and things. And it is a very interesting aspect of our life. But even these super switched on people, it takes time to process information. And actually, sometimes that breaking bad news consultation, you just can't really cover much information. Many patients come back and say, I can't remember anything you told me. And that's why, with taking your example, a young person with Hodgkin lymphoma, the strategy that I've adopted over more recent years is to say, look, there's going to be loads to talk about. But as of today, the one message you've got to hear is there is a very good chance we're going to cure you of this. You're going to go on and have a normal life. I mean, I could have said to you, you're going to go on and then be doing podcasts in years to come. Although I wouldn't have known that. Was 15
years. Didn't you? I'm sure you did.
But I think the somehow to get some sort of positivity into a first meeting is very important, because you're trying to give people things to clutch hold of. And another trick I've learned is you really give people clear follow-up time. So, you know, we're doing this, we're going to do this scan, we're going to do that. I am seeing you in a week. I am seeing you in 2 weeks. These are the contact details. And these are within the NHS plan, and all good clinics know to operate like that. You've got to have communication details. You've got to have information, you know, a named specialist nurse. Some people, let's be honest, don't communicate brilliantly with doctors, but they love talking to the nurses, you know, of course. And so we've got to work out each communication style for each individual.
Yeah, no, of course, because going back to your point at 18, you know, when I was originally diagnosed, as you say, there's just that element of sort of dumbfoundedness when you get that initial information or shock.
Well, 18 years old. I mean, nothing... 18-year-olds, you're charging around, you know.
Well, exactly. I think for me, you're like, oh, my God, I just want to go and have a pint or try and get laid. You know, it is just one of those things. And it's just, yeah, information overload. But
yeah. Do you remember anything from your first consultations? I bet you don't remember any details. So.
I know, unfortunately, well, it wasn't you the first time, because I had a different doctor then, but I just remember being sort of very sort of hands in my head, just like a sort of caught in the spotlight. Just like,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's tough. It's tough.
And I think thereafter as well, exactly that. I think actually thereafter it was more, as much as I've sort of alluded in sort of prior to this, that, you know, you have your friends and family around you for support. It's not until you actually meet other patients or are sort of in the environment that actually weird enough, for me, it felt more reassuring then than it did going around sort of getting support from friends and family, because it was just such an unknown at the time.
It is. And there are the weirdness, particularly with teenagers, which it is, because it is so tough. When you are young, you are not meant to be ill. Our society doesn't do ill in teenagers. Our society does, you know, all the stuff you see on Facebook, Instagram, the media, you know, you're out doing stuff. So it is immensely tough. And with young people as well, we see these strange emotional sways. I don't know, I should be asking you, Charlie, when you'd finished treatment and got your remission first time round, did you get a bit of an emotional dip about 3 or 4 months afterwards? And I'll give you the background, because we see with teenagers in particular that when we pull them into our fold and we take them away from their blossoming independent lives and we bring them into the clinic and we give them structure and chemotherapy and radiotherapy and nurses and blood tests, and you take over, you almost turn them back into children, with us being a very parental type thing. And it's a strange thing that you then release them into the world, you've finished, dusted, you've had your last scan, you're cured. And then they can quite commonly, 3 or 4 months down the line, have a sort of, oh my goodness, where am I type thing. It's almost like a PTSD. People talk about a wave that suddenly catches over and hits them 3, 4 months later. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting you pay mentions that. I mean, I personally, was there a sort of slump, if you like, as you mentioned? I know I went out and had a party. I certainly know that much once I finished. But I don't recall there was. But I think, you know, if that clearly, as you say, everyone's different in terms of, you know, how they deal with these sort of this, and you know, I guess that's where, you know, and evidently this is why I'm here now, as a sort of a resource. But clearly, that's where resources and everything otherwise are really important, I think, because, you know, be that the peaks and troughs that patients or prior patients sort of might be going through.
Yeah,
I think, and just having that sense of community is really important, isn't it? Or yeah, something to just fall back on, at least.
And because you can't necessarily predict them, you can have people who are completely switched on, absolutely fine, and then a year after their treatment, they can have these dips. It's I mean, you were too busy sunbathing and going around the world, no doubt, chasing poor young women.
I thought we weren't going to sort of pay mention to that, but I know. I mean, we go to the treatments, but, you know, let's say every single patient is different, right? Their DNA makeup, exception otherwise. But, you know, you have to, as a takeaway, you know, I'd always call you my personal Willy Wonka, if you like, in terms of pulling, you know, that from this shelf, this from shelf area. Right, this is the perfect for me, the perfect remedy that is going to be the best potential in terms of trying to. What's the word I'm looking for?
What?
Defeat
cure it.
Beats cure. Cure, that's the word. God, I should know that. Cure. Exactly.
You're allowed
that.
To use this word now, Charlie.
Because then, you know, and then they all have their different side effects, you know, be that hair loss, infertility and everything otherwise. So I guess, is there a fine line of trying to say, I want to do the best for my patient, but without sort of doing the most damage? Does that sound right?
Yeah, no. So, Charlie, I mean, you're going straight to the nub of cancer treatment. Is obviously you're trying to optimize results while minimizing both short and long-term toxicity, because all of our drugs are poisonous in their own way. And, you know, you may or may not remember when I consented you for treatment, I had to include that. What is the percentage chance that you actually die because of chemotherapy? Because anyone taking medical consent in this day and age has got to talk about not just the everyday side effects, the nausea and vomiting, but the more serious stuff. You touched on infertility. You touched on organ damage. People getting sick, coming into hospital. You actually had quite a good run with all of that type of stuff, but not everybody does. And it is very challenging. I think you overcompliment me on my Willy Wonka style of plucking this from the shelf. And that, I mean, cancer treatment and medicine is quite regulated. That we work within broad guidelines of how we apply different treatments. Your case was actually a little bit unusual, which is why we sort of did a bit of mixing and matching. But, you know, it panned out well, and so that's what we're always aiming for.
But then you will always, as you say, you'll always preach to me thereafter, you know, as you say, the long term, you've got to be very self-aware in terms of about your day-to-day, be that exposure to some alcohol, drugs, whatever it is, you know, you've just got to start thinking a little bit more clever.
Yeah, cardiovascular health.
I think you said we found a hole in my heart, didn't you?
Oh, God, yeah.
It's broken a few times, but I didn't realise it had a hole.
Well, that is, again, back to the joy of modern medicine and screening. The more tests you do in a human being, you find the tiniest bits of this, tiniest bits of that. So we're not going to worry about that. No, Charlie, you've followed all the rules apart from coming back with your suntan constantly.
So. Yeah.
I think that might be the third time I mentioned it, so I won't mention it again.
No, not at all. Suntan that is now sadly gone, given that I've been in the UK for God knows how long since, but there we go. I'm just trying to think, you know, and in terms of information, sort of now that we've got you here, you know, for those listeners.
Well, I think the key thing is trying to retain positivity. I think we see, you and I both know, you meet all sorts of different characters in life. You have the glass half empty and the glass half full person. I think when you are taking on a cancer diagnosis, cancer treatment, we all get the impression that people that try and approach it in a positive can do well. They sort of manage psychologically, I guess, a bit better with the symptoms. I'm not saying they are more likely to be cured. I don't want somebody listening to this who thinks I'm a glass half empty person. I've got no chance. Right. I mean, that's obviously not true at all. But I think people like you, when you went through your treatment, you were always really positive. You know, you tick off the things. Sometimes you just got to take each day as it comes, and you do better by not thinking the bigger picture, because you can't, because it's so crazily complicated. You got to get through this Tuesday. You got to get through this week. You got to get yourself to March. You got to get yourself to the end of that treatment block. And I think setting those little goals, eating well, staying healthy, keeping social networks. You know, you had that. You had your great family. I was reminding you the other day that your lovely father, and when you finished your treatment, he gave me a nice bottle. That was very decent of him. Family networks, they really do help. See, it helps share the bad times. It helps all of you enjoy the good times when they come as well. So I think those things can all help people getting through tough times. But, you know, it's just think sensibly. And if you're having a good day, you get out, you do some exercise, you go walk and keep yourself mobile. Good data supports that. Exercise as part of cancer therapy is a good thing. I mean, these are all probably fairly obvious things that your listeners will resonate with, but perhaps worth saying.
Well, no, 100%. And I think that's a massive takeaway from this is, you know, whilst it can be an extremely daunting time, you know, to retain some kind of PMA, positive mental attitudes, I think in life generally is a good thing, right? But in particular, you know, in terms of someone
agree with that.
Taking on sort of cancer treatment, I think, try if one can, you know, with a smile on your face, as wretched as it might be, and the peaks and troughs that you're likely to sort of embark on, you know, as you go through the journey, right?
The challenges of life.
Yeah. The challenges of life, exactly. Yeah, so let's not go down that route, otherwise we could be here forever, right?
Well, you've got many other podcasts to come, Charlie, so we'll be listening intently.
Fingers crossed, this doesn't fall. You know, I did mention you were the first, so, and I'm sure, you know, thus far, this has been absolutely fascinating. Just, you know, everyone's trying to find the cure for cancer, right? You know, and let's hope one day that does finally happen. But, you know, what for you in your lifetime would sort of potentially be like utopia, if you like, just particularly maybe specifically for all things blood cancer?
I think, of course, when people talk about the cure for cancer, that is, of course, too simplistic, because cancer is so many different things. It's like saying the cure for infectious diseases when, you know, malaria is totally different from tuberculosis and pancreatic cancer is totally different from lymphoma. But I think if you said to me, what are the major areas of breakthrough? They are understanding how cancer cells signal within them. So how they are getting their growth signals, how they're dividing, how they're metastasizing, and being able to target these key signaling pathways that have gone wrong. We can target them with what we call small molecule inhibitors. So these are the things you take as tablets. And if I see in my field, but also in other fields, how these have already made such a major impact. So that's point number one. But point number two has to be how we are harnessing the immune system, how we're harnessing our own immune systems to attack cancer. And that comes within our bodies. So infusing specific antibodies that enhance what we call T-cell mediated killing of cancer. So there are these things called the PD-1 blockers that remove this inhibitory go-to-sleep signal on our immune system. It's so weird, but a lot of cancers are thriving because they, in effect, are putting our immune system to sleep. And Nobel Prize in Medicine a few years ago was centered on this whole principle about this PD-1 axis. And for some cancers, like Hodgkin lymphoma, it seems to work amazingly well, and other solid organ cancers. And then you have other cancers, such as the leukemias, where this targeting at this axis just doesn't seem to make any difference. But that's all broadly in the whole immune area, the arena of the immune system. And that keeps on expanding. We can manipulate our cells. There's this thing called CAR T-cell medicine, which is now rolling out in certain areas of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and acute leukemia, where you harvest off a patient's T-cells, you send them over to California, and they manipulate them in a lab. They get them to express a special construct that attacks the cancer. You grow them up, get loads of these cells, whiz them back to the UK. We then bring them into the hospital, give them a bit of chemo, infuse their supercharged T-cells, which then attack the cancer. And honestly, one infusion will put it into a remission. And we in Cambridge, like other of the national CAR T-cell centres, are seeing remarkable data. Patients who truly would have been dying from their refractory, aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphomas and acute leukemias, who have been cured by this strategy. Now, it doesn't work for everyone, so it's not a sort of win on every occasion. But when you said to me, what have I seen and what do I continue to expect in terms of the major things, it's that type of thing, learning how we manipulate immune systems to fight off these diseases. But it's part of a big picture, because 10, 20 years from now, we're going to be finding these cancers a lot earlier. We'll intervene with treatments that are much more effective. And we'll keep on going just till the whole body finally falls apart, Charlie. And without being too pessimistic, exactly. We're all going to have dementia in our 90s being left behind.
That's inevitability, right? But well, I think really, you know, I think if we rewind and just that stat I mentioned, I think that can be really probably put us off slightly. But actually, by all accounts, the takeaway here is everything is going in the right direction. And one should be really encouraged by the current sort of landscape in terms of treatment, medicines, everything otherwise.
I think you've got to finish on a positive note. I mean, 100%. On an individual level, you'll have listeners who've been devastated, their families, by cancer, and it is truly, truly awful. In the broad picture, the field moves forward, and you know, many of your listeners will be raising money for cancer charities, they'll be raising money for research, and I just praise them all for the efforts that people are doing, you know, good folk out there doing their bit, and it keeps pushing the field forward.
Awesome. I think that is a really lovely way to sort of wrap things up, George. And I mean, what can I say? It's been an absolute privilege and lovely to see you in a different guise, if you like, on this occasion. And maybe we can try and get you back in a year's time when that medicine and treatment continues on to escalate in terms of embarrassments. But thanks so much for your time.
Well, Charlie, thank you very much having me as your first guest on your podcast.
Well, fantastic. Much. Well, I'll let you get back. You know, you don't want to miss Gladiators, do you, being Saturday evening?
That's me.
All right, mate. Right. Well, I'll see you soon.
You will. Right. Charlie,
take care, buddy. Well, I don't know about you, but I need to take a deep breath. That was truly fascinating. And I hope it was able to give our listeners some peace of mind and reassurance that whilst the stats might not suggest being that of one in two likely get cancer in their lives, in the background, miracles appear to be happening and significant progress really is being made. And to echo George's mention of those amazing people out there working tirelessly, be that the doctors, the nurses, fundraisers, you name it, we thank you. I'm your host, Charlie. This was Talking to Charlie. Keep smiling and be kind. And we look forward to seeing you again soon.